Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is award-winning science writer Carl Zimmer. Our topic is his book of essays regarding some newer research into the brain entitled Brain Cuttings, 15 Journeys Through the Mind. To reach us with questions or comments in Anchorage, you can call 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. Carl Zimmer is an award-winning author and science journalist. He's the author of, by my count now, 10 books, the most recent of which is Planet of Viruses. In addition to writing books, he contributes to the New York Times, National Geographic, Time Magazine, Scientific American, Science, and Popular Science. And he also writes an award-winning blog called The Loom. He's been a previous editor at Discover Magazine, a magazine where he continues to write a monthly column about the brain. And he also hosts a podcast for the American Society of Microbiology called Meet the Scientist. Carl, it's just a great pleasure to have you joining us today. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
One of the more interesting things that I have learned about you is that you've written a textbook, and I want to comment on E.O. Wilson's comments about your book, The Tangled Bank, An Introduction to Evolution. Here's what E.O. Wilson had to say. The Tangled Bank is the best written and best illustrated introduction to evolution of the Darwinian centennial decade, and also the most conversant with ongoing research. It's an excellent for students, the general public, and even for other biologists. And then I wrote a note. It said, it seems to me it's a risky or dangerous endeavor for a science writer to head out alone to write a textbook on any science subject, not just evolution, yet it's received some major accolades, particularly those who know about evolution. So I think that's a remarkable achievement. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What got you into writing a textbook? I know you have a couple of consultants that helped you, but it seems like a big, bold move to me.
Well, I was approached by a textbook publisher who said that he had been talking to a lot of biology teachers, and he said, well, what kind of textbook is not out there yet that you wish existed? And they said, well, we want a textbook about evolution that's for non-majors, people who aren't majoring in biology. Because it turns out that there are actually a lot of new classes being taught these days in college that involve evolution in one way or another that are not just directed at biology majors. And that's a great thing because, you know, evolution shouldn't be just, limited to the biology majors. We all should get to know about it because it's very cool. And so he approached me about writing it because they were thinking that the kind of tone they were looking for, it was along the lines of what I write in articles for the New York Times or Scientific American and so on. So what I then did was I brought together some advisors, scientists who are experts in certain areas of evolution, and, would consult with them and say, look, this is what I think is where the science is now. What do you think? Am I right? Am I wrong? Tell me where I should go if I should be going in a different direction. And out of that came this book, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been 30, 40 years since I've been in college and studied evolution, but I'm trying to stay pretty conversant in this whole area of science. And I think it is it's amazing how much we now know and where it's led us to the thinking about life and how life has evolved and how things are led to change and evolve over time. And as a general public reading it, I found it pretty detailed at times, find it difficult. So I was thinking perhaps it was more for the introducing biology as well. But I get what I'm saying is not to be critical, but to say it's just amazing to me that a science writer and not a professional, academician has written it. It is truly easy to read and very, very well illustrated, as Dr. Wilson comments.
Well, thanks. I mean, the illustrations are really important to me. I mean, I can take care of the writing, but I really value collaborating with artists and designers who love to put together a good book. And One person I worked with is someone named Carl Buell, who I've worked with off and on for, gosh, maybe 15 years now on various books and magazine articles and so on. And whenever I want to get a picture of some animal that once lived long ago and now no longer lives, a dinosaur or some bizarre fish that lived 400 million years ago, he's the guy I go to because he just loves bringing these things to life. And so he did a number of the pictures in the book and also on the cover.
I want to make sure we keep moving towards medicine, but it's such a good opportunity to talk with you and also to talk a little bit about the public understanding of science. So I want to mention and ask you to discuss the creature on the cover and the story of that, because to me it at least demonstrates one of the powerful characteristics of science, and that's if we're getting the story right, then we ought to be able to predict some findings, and that's what to me I think this did. So you want to talk about your cover?
Yeah. So the cover has a very weird creature on it. It's called Tiktaalik, and it was probably about maybe 3 feet long. And, you know, if you saw it crawling around today in a stream, you might think it was some really weird giant salamander with big teeth and gills, which would have been strange because salamanders don't, in fact, have true gills like fish do. It lived about 370 million years ago. And it's actually an intermediate between our ancestors that lived in the water and were fish and life vertebrates on land. So this fossil, the discovery of this fossil a few years back, was really important understanding where we come from. Now, the way it was discovered was really remarkable. And as you say, it's a case of a sort of scientific detective story. So a couple scientists, Neil Shubin of the University of Chicago and Ted Deschler, who's at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, they wanted to find a fossil that really told them a lot about how we went from being fish to being, you know, vertebrates with arms and legs and lungs and all that. And so there were a few fossils that kind of straddled that transition, but there was kind of a hole in the middle, as it were. And so they looked at sort of the ages of those fossils, those other fossils, those fish fossils that were a bit like us, and the land vertebrate fossils that were still kind of fishy. And they said, okay, well, they're all found at around the same period of time, around 360, 370 million years ago. And they are all in these kind of coastal-type rocks that had formed around, like, coastal wetlands, for example. So where's a place where people haven't looked for these kinds of fossils from this age, from these environments? It turned out that one place where people really hadn't looked very much was a certain part of northern Canada. So they packed up, and they loaded their shotguns, and they, because there are polar bears around there, and they went up there for a number of years looking around each summer and kept not quite finding what they were looking for. They'd find fish and things, but they were not quite finding this transitional form until just one day they suddenly started digging up this thing that actually had feet with toes on it, and yet also had gills, and it was this combination of fish and land vertebrate. And so it was, you know, exactly where they had suspected it would be. And so that's part of the kind of predictive power of evolution. It actually gives you ideas about where to do more science.
And if you can predict it and go out and find it, it just reaffirms that the ideas, the theories are real explanations of how the natural world works.
That's right. They fit into the things that you found before and enrich it. So so this particular fossil, Tiktaalik, basically it became a new branch on the tree of life that includes us, that includes our fish relatives. And it shows you how, you know, in our ancestors, some of our traits evolved before other ones. So, for example, Tiktaalik already had it already had a neck. You know, fish don't really have necks, but Tiktaalik already had kind of a neck, and it had digits. It had toes, basically. And yet, it still breathed with it could still breathe with gills, and it still probably lived entirely underwater. It might have crept out on dry land once in a while, but it was kind of, you know, our evolution was kind of a patchwork, and discovering things like Tiktaalik shows you the order in which things happen. Just like we know now that our human ancestors, they stood upright millions of years before they got big brains. And that's something that would have really surprised Darwin, because Darwin thought that as soon as our ancestors stood upright on two legs, that somehow evolving big brains was part of that. But it wasn't.
So what happened first? You get interested in science, or did you get interested in writing, or I don't remember?
I think I was always interested in science. And I was always writing. I didn't sort of consciously put them together. And, you know, I didn't go to a science writing program or anything like that. A couple years out of college, I was looking for work, basically. And I thought, you know, maybe I could look around to see if there are any openings or entry-level jobs at magazines. And I just happened to get an offer to come in to take a copy editing test at Discover Magazine, which is a science magazine. And, you know, they said, okay, you can do some copy editing here. And then one thing led to another, and eventually I was writing pieces and really enjoying it. And so only in hindsight can I say that it makes sense.
All right, well, let's get to some medicine, and particularly the mind and the brain. Your book, Brain Cuttings, 15 Journeys Through the Mind, how did that come about?
Well, I've been writing a lot about the brain in the past couple of years. I'm a columnist at Discover, and so every month there I write about the brain. And then I also write feature articles, separate articles for places like the New York Times and other magazines, on the brain as well. And, you know, I thought, well, this would be kind of interesting to bring together as a collection. And so I thought, well, why don't I do that? And so I've selected 15 of my favorites and put them together. And they, you know, they cover a really wide range of neuroscience, from, you know, what are the cells that make up our brain to you know, to how do we recognize each other's faces, to whether we'll be able to upload our brains into a computer. Just trying to span the huge amount of research that is going on in neuroscience these days.
Let me take just a second to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is science writer Carl Zimmer. We're going to be discussing and are beginning to discuss his book, Brain Cuttings. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. This is an ebook, and I think it's the first time I've interviewed anybody that's done an ebook. So I want to just briefly mention about ebooks, how available they are, where you get them, and so there's no published paper of this particular book either. Is that correct?
That's right. This only exists as pixels, which is kind of an interesting experiment for me. You know, the whole ebook side of the book publishing industry has been exploding, and not only that, but you know, the sort of traditional route of writing a book proposal and working through a large publisher, that's no longer mandatory for ebooks. You know, Amazon will basically take something and put it up on their Kindle site, and you're done, and all of a sudden, you know, it's for sale. So I was curious last year when I got this idea about putting together a collection of pieces, and I thought, well, let me just try this out. So so I worked with designers, and we put together this ebook, which is now in various formats. So you can find it as a Kindle. People who use iPhones or iBooks. They can go to the iBook store, and it's in these other major ebook sellers.
This, again, I'm going to make just a short detour because it comes to my mind, and it may be worth making sure our listeners have heard some discussion of this. This, all of this business of the explosion of the internet and the availability of tremendous amounts of information very easily also brings up the issue that traditional journalism no longer is present in the sense that there's this fact-checking in many of these books that now can be published and what you read on the internet. And so the reliability, I mean, it makes some sense to think about that that may not be true, but perhaps people don't appreciate the difference between, you know, publishing something for the New York Times and the fact checking that must go on in that and in a normal, certainly a textbook, and what you can get in an ebook or on the internet.
Well, you know, I'm finding myself trying to teach my children that everything that you come across on the internet is not necessarily true. and that actually, it takes some work, because they just say, well, it's on my computer and therefore it must be right. And I think that there, you know, you need to have a very healthy skepticism about things on the internet, because, as you say, I mean, the threshold for putting stuff online and in effect publishing is quite low. So yeah, I mean, anybody can put up whatever they want. Now, that doesn't mean that the internet is a terrible, horrible thing. It just means that people need to be savvy, and they need to kind of take charge of their own fact-checking, as it were. So that means, you know, what do you know about the writer, for example? What do you know about the place where they're publishing? You know, perhaps there are some people on blogs who have pointed out all the problems in this article or ebook that you're reading. Maybe you can do a little critical reading there. You know, the fact is, however, that it's not as if these problems didn't exist before people started to blog or to publish ebooks. In fact, a lot of the best work on science-related blogs these days is critiquing bad journalism that appears in traditional outlets, whether they're television shows or books or newspaper articles. I mean, there's no those traditional formats are not immune to bad information. So you know, there just needs to be just sort of an all-around skepticism and a willingness to kind of dig deep.
Let's get back then to your book, Brain Cutting. So one of the things that anytime any new technology, any new help for the human animal occurs, we wonder if it's going to have deleterious effects as well as perhaps beneficial effects that we take advantage of. And you address this issue of new computer technologies and how it may be affecting the human mind. Perhaps you might want to discuss a little bit of what you had to say about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's been a big concern about, now that we're spending all our time on the computer or on our smartphones and so on, that this is somehow doing something to our minds. It certainly is changing the way that we get information. So some people have argued that this is, in effect, having a kind of a biological impact on us. So I'm thinking of people, say, like Nicholas Carr, who wrote a book called The Shallows. And he really, makes us a forceful case that reading on the internet and relying on these new kinds of media is having an effect, a biological effect on our brains. We're so busy multitasking and hopping from one thing to another that it's affecting our ability to concentrate, our attention, our memory, all these things. I frankly don't think that there's very much good evidence for that. I mean, there are some experiments where people are asked to multitask, you know, in the lab, like do this and do that at the same time, and then scientists try to measure how that affects attention levels and so on. And you know, there seems to be an effect, but you're looking at just what's happening in a situation that doesn't have that much resemblance to what we do in our day-to-day activity. So I'm skeptical of extrapolating that to these grand pronouncements, you know, that Google is making us stupid and things like that. I don't, you know, when you're going to make such a bold claim, I think you really need to have some really strong evidence. And in fact, what I find seems to be happening is that people are grabbing onto this kind of thin research to justify their pre-existing fears and prejudices. You know, they just feel like, well, you couldn't possibly do anything intelligent or meaningful online, so therefore there must be some research out there that shows that I'm right. And I just don't think it's really there. And I think that there's just a lot of kind of logical problems with that argument. And actually, if you want to trot out biology, well, actually, the biology kind of works against you, I think, because the fact is that our brains are really, they have this weird way of turning our tools into extensions of ourselves. And this didn't start with humans. This started with our primate ancestors. And just to give you an example of what I mean, let's say a monkey is grabbing a pole and is using it to get at some food. Now monkeys, like we do, we have kind of a mental map of their bodies, and that basically lets them, you know, figure out how to control their bodies to interact with their world around them. And now, as soon as they start learning how to use a pole to poke around for something, that map changes so that they're actually their body, in effect, sort of goes to the tip of that pole. Now, there's some really dramatic research that's been done also on monkeys, where scientists have implanted electrodes into their brains and have connected the electrodes to robot arms. And these robot arms can be in another room, or they can be in another country, you know, just with an internet connection. And these monkeys can learn how to manipulate these robot arms just with their thoughts. And when scientists, probe to look at the activity of their brains as they're manipulating a robot arm, using it to grab something, for example, they've turned that robot arm into basically like an extra limb. They've completely reorganized their brain to take advantage of this tool. So if someone tells me, oh my gosh, our brains are changing because we're using computers, I would say, yes, of course they are. I mean, our brains change whenever we use some new kind of tool. So it's not like we have some sort of essential brain that we're degrading by using the computers all the time. I just don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to come back to that a little bit. I loved your analogy of Socrates. I want to use that, but we do have a caller, and I want to ask Carolyn to make her comments. Carolyn, you're on line one?
Yeah, hi, this is Caroline. I had wanted to pose the question. I've always been so baffled by why people are frightened of the concept of evolution, and my thought, the best I could come up with, is that we have a very hard time thinking of ourselves other than as the center of the universe. And that's why the resistance is there. But at the same time, we can embrace and understand the evolution of our technical items, such as people flying with wings and then airplanes, jets, etc. And the same thing applies to all of our electronic devices. That baffles me. But the thing that you're mentioning there with the brain changing, there was a lot of discussion and fear when people started learning to read. because they were no longer talking to each other as frequently as they had before. They were becoming more isolated. And at the same time, you mentioned the monkeys. And I remember the one thing I think humans, I've always felt humans were born with, and that was a sense of fairness. Sin, the concepts of sin are taught based upon the societal aspects. But the idea of being fair, you can watch that in very small children under the age of two and how they react when something is taken away from them but given to someone else. And I think it was the macaque monkeys that the famous study was done with, where one would stop doing the same task when the other one doing the task was given the better treat, such as a grape over a piece of cucumber, I think it was. But these things are just fascinating to me, and I don't understand what the fear is other than the fear of change. Mm-hmm. and the fact that, you know, ultimately, if we think we're lesser than because of change, we can't accept it.
Carl, your comment?
Well, you bring up all sorts of great issues there. Like with reading, for example, it's true that when written language was invented, it was invented. It did not exist forever. And when it was invented, there were people who said, you know, this is a bad thing because we're going to be relying on books and writing to remember things. And in fact, that's going to become our kind of extended memory. So we won't remember things in our own minds where you remember things best. And, you know, it's possible that we did give something up. You know, you hear stories about how poets could recite great epics for hours and hours and hours and on end because they memorized it. And, you know, we don't do that.
The same thing I understand was groups that had things like a cow. If their whole life revolved around that, they would know the lineage of those animals. And years ago when I lived in Samoa, the people who had the responsibility, it was usually the wife of the high chief or the talking chief, they would remember every time a high-valued item, such as a fine mat, was exchanged, every time that it was given and accepted and passed on. So, you know, these things, of course, are important. Memory is very important. I think we can't rely on a little device to tell us how to multiply. You know, we do need that. But at the same time, I embrace change. The only thing I'm worried about right now is that I'm going to have to go out and get some kind of e-reader, but maybe I can get one from the library.
You can just use your phone.
Thank you so much for all of this.
Yep, you bet, Carolyn. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so change is a difficult thing for all of us, and with change, there's always good things and bad things that come. And you make the comment to further on your discussion about how Socrates worried that writing would make people forgetful. It's certainly, maybe we don't have the memory that we used to, but it also created, as you said, a larger pool of knowledge from which people can draw, much like the internet has done.
Yeah, and reading has an effect on people's brains. I mean, it's a measurable one. I mean, we don't fully understand the biology of reading in the brain, but you know, actually, you can now potentially help people with dyslexia by scanning their brain activity before you start giving them particular interventions to help them to learn better strategies for how to read. It's getting down to that kind of fine-grained level of understanding of how reading works in the brain. But it does work in the brain, you know. So if you're worried that some technology is going to change the way our brain works, then really we shouldn't read and leave it at that.
Carl, we're going to have to take a short break. We always do this about halfway through. We'll be right back. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with award-winning science writer Carl Zimmer on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is science writer Carl Zimmer, and we're discussing his book of essays on some newer researches in the area of brain science entitled Brain Cuttings, A 15 Journeys Through the Mind. It's an ebook, and so it's only available online at many of the ebook outlets such as iTunes, Amazon, and Kindle. If you've got questions or comments today about our program, you can reach us through email at line1@kska.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And just remember, if you're listening to Line 1 between 7 and 8, it's a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to take your calls. On this memory issue and how when we learned to write, we didn't have to have as much memory, which I think makes some sense to me. It may be that it hasn't evolved out of us, our memory, because I remember reading recently someone who is beginning to take people and teach them, anybody, not just some special person, how to remember large sequences of numbers that seem unreasonable to us, much like someone might remember word for word a very long epic poem.
Yeah, there is a wonderful book out called Moonwalking with Einstein by Joshua Foer. And Joshua is a journalist who went to report on the annual memory championships, and just, I guess, for the sake of his reporting, thought he could might want to enter it to see what it was like, and then ended up winning the national championships. And so he ended up plunging into this world of memory champions, and it's fascinating how they have developed all of these tools for enhancing their memory and for being able, as you say, to memorize long numbers, or just turn over all the cards in a deck, and people get to look at it, and then you pick up all the cards, and they have to recite the order of those cards, all of them, just from memory, and they can do it. I mean, it's astonishing. But again, you know, what they're doing there is that they are practicing. They're practicing a skill. And when you practice a skill, you change your brain. Our brains are, to some extent, plastic. They're malleable. And when we do new things, it changes the structure and the function of the brain. I mean, scientists have actually done studies on jugglers, believe it or not, where the people would learn how to juggle, and just after about a week of practicing juggling, you could actually see structural changes, sort of thickening of gray matter in certain regions of the brain. So again, they were changing their brains as they became better jugglers.
Yeah, we have done a couple of programs on that, and I'm blocking on the neuroscientist at the NIH who's done a lot of work, not on glia, which hopefully we'll get to, but how, you know, just practicing early and young in particular, we set up these neural pathways that you can, that get myelinated, and then by new technology, you can see the difference in someone who's a pianist who's practiced for years and years and years versus someone who's just learning, and why it's important to start early as well.
Yeah. I mean, when you're young, obviously your brain is growing and you're developing lots of new connections. And so, I mean, it's certainly, if you're going to want to learn a language, it's great to learn it when you have that in that window.
Right.
But, you know, scientists had formerly really thought, if you had asked scientists, say, you know, 50, 40 years ago, they would really say, well, you know, once once you grow up, once you're, you know, even a teenager, your brain is pretty much locked in, and it's sort of downhill from there. But actually, your brain is continuing to develop throughout your life, as you do new things, your brain is continuing to be remolded, and so, you know, it's really worth bearing that in mind.
We have a couple more callers. Let's take Matt from Palmer. Matt, what can we do for you?
Hey, I've just got a 2 points to make, actually, now. One is about what you were just talking about. I think music is probably the biggest, beneficiary to that kind of thing, even if you start playing it late, because it teaches you organization, memory, math, all those kind of things. So that was just a real quick note while I was listening to get on. So why I really called is I am pro-internet, pro-evolution, and pro-change, right? But I do have a devil's advocate point of view as to what you were talking about earlier with the internet changing our brain. So what I'm thinking is everything on the internet is, I've had this thought lately, it's there. It exists, but there's nothing physical about it. It's not actually physical. So the more we come to rely on this entire world that nobody can reach out and touch, and really is an incredibly fragile thing, just disappears, in the blink of an eye, then if that were to happen, people will say children that have been born in the last decade or last 5 years will continue to learn through the internet, and they form their brain in those ways. And if, whatever happened in the internet, the entire internet structure went down, I feel like their whole mental structure would be off, because they would be reliant on this, virtual world. That makes sense?
I understand what you're saying, yes. Carl, any comments?
It's interesting to think about. I mean, just how focused we are in our learning on the internet, and how it will be for children. Certainly, I don't think it's a good idea for children to only learn online. I mean, I would never argue for that. And I think that kids need to get outside. They need to go, walk in the mud and dig up bugs, and just really embrace the world. But it's okay if they then go home and do some research online to find out some more about what they've discovered. Whether it actually could have that kind of a severe effect on our brains, I don't know. I mean, I think you'd have to be in a pretty extreme kind of world. For some reason, you're reminding me of the movie WALL-E, where all the people are stuck on a spaceship just staring at a screen, hovering around on little beds. In a situation like that, you might actually have kind of a neurological problem interacting with the physical world, but I think we're okay for now. We just need to remember to get up away from the computer and go outside.
Right. Even practical things like being able to look up something in the index of a book, or the importance of appendices, and then things like this, that just aren't necessary on the internet. Or even to take it back one step further, we were talking about the advent of reading and how that, the effect it had on oral history. So, and poets and such. So, things like prose when you're speaking, the rhythm and timing that you speak with is not necessary. But if all that were to go down, that's crucial to any kind of a political system,
Right.
So anyways, I'm off on a tangent. So. Well, I just wanted to give a couple points.
Yeah, thanks for your comments, Ben.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
All right. Let's go ahead and we'll take another caller. Larry, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you very much, Dr. Woodard. Our understanding of how the brain works is just increasing exponentially. It seems just this year from listening to your program. How long before we are able to develop artificial consciousness?
That's a great question. I mean, it depends on who you talk to, the answer you get about that. Part of the problem is that we don't have a really solid definition of consciousness yet, or maybe a better word for it is a theory of consciousness. We just don't have it yet. But you know, we're getting there. And, you know, I there are some really innovative ideas that are coming out of research labs these days. So, for example, you know, there's one scientist I wrote about in the New York Times named Giulio Tinoni, who's at the University of Wisconsin, and he has he's been trying to rebuild our idea of consciousness based on something called information theory, and that's actually, you know, the science that's behind, well, behind the phone that I'm using and behind the radio station's transmission and our computers and so on, basically breaking down information into its kind of raw components. James Gleick has a wonderful book out now called The Information, which kind of gives a history of information theory. And so what Tinoni is saying is that, you know, our brains are information processors, and consciousness is a certain form of information processing where we can kind of distinguish lots of different kinds of things around us and different internal states. And he really does think that you can compute this, and he's working with a number of scientists to develop a model to do this. So if you could quantify consciousness like that, I don't see why it wouldn't be possible to wire up a computer that had the same properties, and boom, it should be conscious. That assumes that his theory pans out. We'll see. But these are, this is not any longer sort of the world of kind of armchair speculation. There's a lot of really hardcore research going on in consciousness in the lab, and so it's really exciting to be watching it evolve.
Great, thank you very much.
This kind of leads me, one of my last questions is, where is brain research leading? Last question, not hopefully of today, but that I had on a piece of paper here, is where is it all leading, and then what's the coolest research? And then you might talk about the singularity, since it seems like we're approaching that when we talk about artificial consciousness.
Well, I think, obviously consciousness is this huge challenge for neuroscientists. But it's actually just one aspect of a bigger, broader challenge, which is just trying to understand how the brain works. I mean, if you think about it, the brain is made up of neurons and other cells, and there might be, say, 100 billion neurons, and each of them might have maybe 1,000 connections to other neurons in the brain, and those connections operate in a very complex way, each one, and they can develop new connections and cut away old ones. So you have this incredibly complicated network. And so how does that network work? And how do the little components of the network give rise to kind of a unified whole? I mean, you know, our experience in our brains, it's not, We don't have 100 billion different experiences. We have one experience. It's the unified feeling we have from our brains. And trying to figure out how that network works, that's I think, the challenge for the next century. And a lot of neuroscientists are trying to articulate that now. They're trying to figure out, how do we come to grips with this complexity? And because, actually, neuroscience is actually... The great advances in neuroscience of the past few, say, century or two, have been actually taking the brain apart. If I take away this one part of the brain, what happens? You know, so if someone gets damaged in one particular region, they lose their ability to do math, or they lose their ability to understand music, or have, you know, maybe they, when they close their eyes, they can't picture anything. They lost their mind's eye. In a way, that's sort of like taking pieces out of a very complicated device and seeing how it breaks in interesting ways. Well, we got to put the pieces back together and see how they all work together, and that's hard. And neuroscientists have a long way to go before they really succeed in doing that.
Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is science writer Carl Zimmer, and we're discussing his book, Brain Cuttings, 15 Journeys Through the Mind. These are 15 essays that he's written on some of the newer neuroscience discoveries. If you've got questions or comments, we're into our last quarter hour. You can call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. One of the thoughts I have about our beginning to understand consciousness and the mind in a little bit deeper way is perhaps evolving because of our recognition of what you call the brain's dark matter in your essay, which discusses glia. And the importance of these cells, which are the most numerous in our brain, have become to receive new attention, whereas we've focused in the past a lot on the neurons and neurotransmitters. Is it possible, is it likely, is it reasonable to think that maybe as we understand glia even more, we'll begin to have a better insight into how this thing works called our brain?
Oh, we'll definitely understand a lot more about how our brain works by understanding what's called glia. So the story with glia begins in the 1800s. Scientists had found these structures, which they called neurons, and they knew that neurons were important because they could conduct electricity. So there were these famous experiments where you could shock a neuron in a frog's leg and then leg would twitch. So there was this idea that, well, the nervous system runs on electricity. But then people found this other kind of tissue in the brain, and it didn't seem to have anything to do with conducting electricity. So they called it glia, which is Latin for glue. So really, they just thought it was just kind of a scaffolding that kind of, or almost like a jelly in which the neurons could sit. And glia kind of got ignored for a long time, partly because of this assumption. But of course, it turns out now that that glia, which, as you say, make up actually most of the cells in our brain, it could be 100 billion or several hundred billion glial cells in our brain, they're very much alive, and they're very much doing all sorts of different, really important things. Now, some of them are they basically act like the immune system of the brain. They clean up damaged bits of cells to keep the brain in good shape. Glia also are the cells that get nutrients from our bloodstream and ship it to the neurons. Basically, they're feeding the neurons. But then they're also doing all sorts of other things that are actually more involved in what we would call thought. So they're regulating different levels of molecules involved in the communication between neurons, these neurotransmitters like dopamine or serotonin. So they're playing a role there. Now, the weirdest thing and probably the most controversial idea is that glia are actually doing the kind of information processing that we associate with thought. They're doing it too. Now, this is kind of weird because they don't send these little electric pulses the way regular neurons do. So they have to be doing something else. And so scientists have been really interested to see that there are these peculiar waves of charged calcium charged calcium atoms that flow across these cells. There are these what they call them calcium waves, and they travel from one end of the cell to another. And there's some signs that maybe these waves can, the information in those waves can go from one glial cell to the next. And so they might be able to take the information in these waves and process it. What's really fascinating is that, you know, our neurons, like I said, they use these little spikes of voltage. So if you listen to a neuron, it makes these kind of clicking sounds. And that's kind of like digital technology. It's like these pops of ones and zeros, as it were, kind of like our computers work. But if these glial cells really are, quote-unquote, thinking, maybe they're doing it in an analog way, gently rising and falling levels of electric charge. And it could be a totally different way of processing information that we just don't understand yet.
It's really, really fascinating. We haven't mentioned also that an area of cognitive neuroscience where we're beginning to understand the reasons why we have problems, for example, changing our mind or accepting that we've made mistakes and so forth. It's a whole area, and I don't believe you addressed that particularly, but I just, in your book, but I think it's an important area to recognize that we're beginning to understand how we might get embedded in certain thoughts and why it's difficult to change.
Yeah, well, you know, our brains did not evolve so that we could be, you know, well-adjusted members of 21st century society. And you know, our brains evolved to produce decisions that tended to keep our ancestors alive and allow them to have more kids. And so, you know, that means that we may not necessarily be thinking the way we wish we were thinking. And so, as you say, sometimes we can get stuck on ideas that are wrong, and it's very hard to become unstuck. Another problem we have is just dealing with certain kinds of math, for example. Probability is very hard for us to think about. And people do terribly thinking in terms of probability, in terms of risk, for example. If a test has a certain false positive rate and a false negative rate, people do terribly at guessing how accurate that test will be. Even doctors do badly at it. And there's actually a lot of research going on into why it is that we do badly on that kind of thought process. Whereas there are other kinds of thought that we do incredibly well. So, for example, recognizing faces. I mean, faces are very complex images, and two different faces may be barely different if you just look at them just in terms of the basic differences of those images. And yet, we're all very good at recognizing faces. We can remember many, many, many faces, and we can remember them for decades. There are some people who have what's known as face blindness, and they can't remember people's faces, but they are the exceptions. So here we have this strange brain which is incredibly good at memorizing hundreds of differences of faces, and yet can stumble over some really basic mathematics. Ultimately, it's just our evolutionary legacy.
I kind of had, before we came on the air, as I think about this, and I'm much, much more simplistic than in my thoughts than you have been, is it's another way our brain is protecting ourselves. I mean, we're good at looking at images or objects and identifying what's safe and what's not. I mean, that kept us alive, as people would say. It's important to not mess up or mistake a kitten for a tiger. That doesn't forebode well for our life, and yet how we think about different bits of information given to us may not be all that important. So maybe that has some evolutionary reason why we certain things are more easy to do, and statistics might not be very important from an evolutionary standpoint.
That's right. I mean, and there are things that we would that might seem like things we'd rather do without, like anxiety and fear. Fear is an incredibly useful instinct, as is pain. I mean, none of us really enjoy, the feeling of chronic pain and so on. But there are actually people who have, genetic disorders where they don't feel pain, and they get themselves into all sorts of trouble, they can end up, with having to get arms amputated and so on because they don't know that they're hurting themselves. They don't can't sense that there's something wrong with their body, and it's a real disaster. Unfortunately, that means that we all have to deal with the side effects, as it were, of our pain system. So we can get stuck with chronic pain that has no source, for example. But, unfortunately, you have to take the bad with the good when you've evolved a kind of system like our pain sensing system.
In the last couple of minutes, you do mention that we begin now to think about the mind as working, or the brain, in certain networks such as executive control, which may have an impact on our attention, and a disorder such as ADD, and so in areas that are focused just on language or math and so forth. You mentioned the default network, and that's a concept I had not heard of. Would you mind just mentioning that briefly in the last couple of minutes?
Sure. This comes out of research on brain imaging. And the way that brain imaging works typically is, you know, you lie down in an fMRI scanner, and then a scientist has you do something. So you might, they'll have be a little monitor in there, and they might say, okay, we're going to show you pictures of faces, and we want you to, like, imagine what those people are like. Or we're going to show you some arithmetic, and we want you to add the numbers. And people do that, and certain regions of their brain become more active than if they were not doing those activities. And so scientists can compare these pictures, as it were, and start to zero in on certain regions of the brain that are important for these kinds of tasks. And so with pain, for example, there's actually, you know, scientists actually stick little tiny laser beams into people's feet just to give them a little bit of pain, and they can identify what's called the pain matrix. So, but that's when your brain is doing something. Well, scientists thought, well, let's take a look at the brain when it's not doing anything. And so they just had people just sort of lie there and just not think about anything. And lo and behold, there are actually certain parts of the brain that are quite active when they're not doing anything, and actually become more quiet when they do other tasks. And this has become known as the default network. It's always on. And it's probably what it's doing is it's letting us continuously, unconsciously reflect on ourselves. We're incorporating our experiences and making sense of them, and actually, like, thinking about new plans, what we're going to do with the information and our experiences, and think about the future. So when you're reading a book, actually, and your mind kind of wanders, actually what happens is that the areas of the brain that are involved in reading kind of quiet down, and the default network switches on. So your default network, even when you're trying to do something, will just switch on from time to time, just to sort of, in a sense, to let yourself, as it were, keep kind of integrating these new experiences.
Really, really, really fascinating. Well, Carl, it's been a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with you, and keep up the good work so some of us can keep track of what's happening in science.
Well, thank you so much.
Let me make sure our listeners know you can get his book, Brain Cuttings, 15 Journeys Through the Mind, at any ebook outlet such as iTunes, Kindle, and Amazon. Next week, Line One returns. My guest will be Dr. Mark Sawyer, professor of pediatrics and infectious disease at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. We're going to be discussing refusal of vaccines and immunizations in the United States, the history, the reasons for it, and the effects on health. Pat Yack is vice president of public health. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thanks for those of you who listened, and especially those who called. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line One, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.